Day minus 2, 08:30. Jen wakes up, sweat gathered across her chest. Her phone is lying on the bedside table, but she doesn't check it. A perverse impulse to keep hope alive resides within her. She pulls on Kelly's dressing gown, still damp in places from his shower, and heads downstairs. The wooden floors are lit up by the sun, glossy with it. The honey light warms her toes and then her feet as she steps forwards. Please don't let it be Friday again. Anything but that. She peers into the kitchen, hoping to see Kelly, but it's empty. Tidy, too. The counter's clear. She blinks. The pumpkin. It isn't here. She walks into the kitchen, then spins around uselessly, just looking, but it's nowhere. Maybe it's Sunday. Maybe it's over. She brings her phone out of the dressing gown pocket, holds a breath, then checks it. It is the 27th of October. It is the day before. Blood pounds in her forehead, hot and stretched like somebody's turned a heater on. She must be mad, she must be. The pumpkin isn't here because it hasn't yet been purchased by her. Apparently, it is Thursday, 8:30 in the morning. Todd will be on his way to school. Kelly will be at Merrilocks. And Jen should be at work. She looks out at their garden, the grass gilded by the early morning sun. She makes and gulps a coffee that only jangles her nerves further. If she's right, tomorrow will be Wednesday, then Tuesday, and then what, backwards forever? She's sick again, this time into the kitchen sink, spewing up sweet black coffee, panic and incomprehension. Afterwards, she rests her head briefly on the ceramic edge and makes a decision. She needs to talk to someone who understands her, her oldest friend and colleague, Rakesh. The street outside Jen's work is often blustery, caught in a wind tunnel in Liverpool city centre. The October air gusts her coat up and around her thighs like a bawdy dancer's. Later it will begin to rain, huge fat drops that turn the air frigid. Jen had wanted to live closer to town, but Crosby was as close as Kelly said he'd get. He hates the noise of cities, doesn't like the mess, the bustle. Also, Scousers, except you, he had said once, she thinks in jest. Kelly left his hometown behind when he met Jen. Both parents dead, his school friends all wasters, he says. He hardly goes back. The only connection he has to it is an annual camping trip with old friends on the Whitsun weekend. He wanted to live out in the wilderness, he said, but she made him move back to Crosby with her. But the suburbs are full of people, he'd said. He is often this way, dark humour crossed with cynicism. She pushes open the warm glass door, the foyer ablaze with sunlight, and heads down the corridor to Rakesh's. Rakesh Kapoor, her biggest ally and longtime friend, was a doctor before he became a lawyer. Ludicrously overqualified, logical to a fault. Jen thinks he's the kind of man Todd might become. The thought hits her with a wave of sadness. She finds him in the kitchen, stirring sugar into a tea. The kitchen is a small, soulless, dark purple space with a stock image on the wall of a sunset. Jen remembers her father choosing this burgundy colour when they took the lease here 3 years ago, 18 months before he died. The paint had been called sour grapes. Perfect for a law firm foyer, Jen had said, and her father, usually serious, had exploded into sudden, beautiful laughter. Rakesh greets her with only a raise of his dark eyebrows and a lift of his full mug. He, like Jen, is not a morning person. Do you have a minute, she says. Her voice trembles in fear. He'll never believe her. He'll cart her off somewhere, section her, but what else can she do? Sure. She leads him down the corridor and back to her office, where she perches on the edge of her messy desk. Rakesh hovers in the doorway but closes the door when he sees her hesitate. His bedside manner is excellent, kind but jaded. He favours sweater vests and poorly fitting suits. He left medicine because he didn't like the pressure. He says law is worse, only he doesn't want to leave a second career. They became friends the day she hired him, when, in his interview, he said his biggest professional weakness was office donuts. Jen's office faces east and is lit with morning sun. One wall is lined with haphazard files in pink, blue and green, their ends sun-bleached, a sure sign they ought to be archived, something Jen finds far less interesting than seeing clients. "How do you feel about giving a medical consult?" she asks Rakesh with a small laugh, followed by a deep breath. "Unqualified," he says lightly, as quick as ever. "Your disclaimer is safe with me." Rakesh takes his suit jacket off and drapes it over the back of the dark green armchair Jen has in the corner. A proprietary gesture, but a fitting one too. Jen and Rakesh have spent almost every weekday lunchtime together for a decade. They buy baked potatoes from a van which calls itself Mr. Potato Head. Rakesh collects the loyalty stamps, in the shape of potatoes, all year, and at Christmas he gets them tons of free ones. He blocks it out in their calendars as Christmas Spudding. "What disease would you have if you were in a time loop? As in, what does Bill Murray have in Groundhog Day?" she asks, thinking it's been so long since she watched it. "I mean, mental illness-wise." Rakesh says nothing initially, just stares at her. Jen feels herself blush with both shame and fear. "I would go for stress," he says eventually, steepling his hands together carefully. "Or a brain tumour, temporal lobe epilepsy, retrograde amnesia, traumatic head injury. Nothing good." Rakesh doesn't answer again, just communicates an expectant, doctorly pause to her across her office. She hesitates. "If tomorrow will be yesterday, does anything matter anyway?" "I am pretty sure," she says carefully, not looking directly at him, "that I woke up on the 29th of October, then the 28th again, and now the 27th. "I'd say you need a new diary," he says lightly. "But something happened on the 29th. Todd, he commits a crime. The day after tomorrow." "You think you've been to the future?" Rakesh says. Jen's fear has simmered down to a kind of burning low-level panic. She feels exhausted. "Do you think I'm mad?" "Nope," Rakesh says calmly. "You wouldn't ask that if you were." "Well then," Jen says with a sigh, "I'm glad I did." "Tell me exactly what happened." Rakesh crosses her office and stands closer to her by her window, which overlooks the high street below. Jen loves that old-fashioned window. She'd insisted it be openable when she chose this room. In the summer, she feels the hot breeze and hears the buskers. In the winter, the drafts make her cold. It's nice to be aware of the weather rather than a sterile 18-degree office. He folds his arms, his wedding ring catching the sunlight. He is looking closely at her, his eyes scanning her face. She is suddenly self-conscious under his gaze, as though he is about to uncover something awful, something deadly. "Start at the beginning. Which is this Saturday?" He pauses. "Okay, then." He spreads his hands like, "So be it," his face in the shade of the low sun. He stands in silence for over a minute when she has finally finished speaking, telling him every detail, even the strange things, the pumpkin, her naked husband. In the anxiety of it all, she has lost all dignity, not caring what he thinks of her. "So, you're saying today has happened before, and now it is happening again in mostly the same ways," he says incisively, capturing the logic or otherwise of Jen's situation completely. "Yes." "So, what did we do the first time you experienced today, on the first 27th? Jen sits back in her chair. What a smart question. She looks at his face properly for a few seconds. She needs to relax, to be able to work this out. She puffs the air from her lungs, eyes closed for just a second. Something comes to her, drifting from the back of her brain to the front. "Do you have weird socks?" she says. "I think, maybe, we might have laughed at your socks when we went for potatoes. Pink." Rakesh blinks, then slips the leg of his trousers up. "I do indeed," he says with a laugh, showing her a pair of cerise socks that say Usher on them. That's right, he attended a wedding last weekend, got them as a gift. "Hardly foolproof, is it?" she says. "Look, it's stress, probably," Rakesh says quickly. "You're coherent. You do know the date. I'd go with something, I don't know, anxiety? You're a bit prone that way anyway, aren't you? Or depression can make days feel the same, like you're getting nowhere. This isn't psychosis." "Thanks, I hope not. I mean, I have to say," Rakesh says, humour laced through his voice, "I have absolutely no fucking idea." "Me neither," she says, feeling lighter for having spoken to somebody nevertheless. "Maybe you just got confused," he says. "Happens to me all the time in small ways. I couldn't remember driving here the other day. Could not tell you for the life of me which way I went. It isn't dissociation, is it? It's life. Get more sleep. Eat some vegetables." "Yeah." Jen turns away from his gaze and wrenches up the sash window. "It isn't that. That is forgetfulness. Not this. And this isn't stress." "Of course it isn't." She looks down at Liverpool below her. She's here. She's in the here and now. Autumn wood smoke drifts in. The sun warms the backs of her hands. "My friend did something about time travel for his PhD," Rakesh says.
"Did he?"
"Yes, a study on whether getting stuck in a time loop is possible. I proofread it."
"He did... what was it?"
Rakesh leans against the wall, arms folded, his suit bunched at the shoulders. "Theoretical physics and applied maths, with me, at Liverpool. And then he went on to study... God, something nuts. He's at John Moore's now."
"What's his name?"
"Andy Vertese." Rakesh reaches into his suit trouser pocket, pulls an open packet of cigarettes out. "Anyway, take these off me, please. I'm slipping back." "Call yourself a doctor," Jen says lightly, holding her palm out for the box. She smiles at Rakesh as he turns to leave, but she is thinking about how she really, truly is here on Thursday. She feels calmer, having discussed it with somebody she trusts, more able to assess it objectively.
So how has it happened? How did she do it? Is it when she sleeps? And what does she have to do to get out of it?
She stares down at the battered cigarette box.
It must be that she has to change things. To change things in order to stop it, to save Todd and to get out of it.
"If I remember, I'll wear different socks the next time we meet," Rakesh says, with an enigmatic smile, one hand on the doorframe. He leaves and she waits a second, then calls out, "Quit!" into the corridor, wanting to change something, anything for the better. "It's so unhealthy." "I know," Rakesh says, his back to her, not turning around. Jen fires up her computer and begins Googling time loops. Why not research them? It's what any good lawyer would do. Two scientists called James Ward and Oliver Johnson have written a paper on the bootstrap paradox, going back in time to observe an event which, it turns out, you caused. Jen writes this down. To enter a time loop, they say, you would need to create a closed time-like curve. They provide a physics formula. But helpfully, they break it down underneath. It seems to happen when a huge force is exerted on the body. Ward and Johnson think the force would have to be stronger than gravity to create a time loop. She scrolls down. The force would need to be 1,000 times her body weight. She sinks her head into her hands. She doesn't understand a single word of this. And 1,000 times her weight is... a lot. She breaks into a grim smile, an amount not worth contemplating.
She goes back to Google and clicks, desperately, on an article called Five Easy Tips to Escape a Time Loop. Is this a thing? There truly is something for everybody on the internet. The five tips are mixed. Find out why, tell a friend and get them to loop with you. Sure. Document everything, experiment, and try not to die. The last one unsettles Jen. She hadn't thought of it at all. Something eerie seems to arrive in the room as she thinks of it. Try not to die. What if that's where this is headed? Some place even darker than that first night, some maternal sacrifice, bargaining with the gods. She switches off her monitor. There must be a way to make Kelly believe her, her biggest ally, her lover, her friend, the man she is her most silly, unpretentious self with. She will try to prove it to him, and then he can help her. Her trainee, Natalia, walks by, wheeling a trolley of lever arch files past Jen's office that Jen has already seen arrive once before. She is about to steer the trolley accidentally into the closed doors of the lift. Jen closes her eyes as she hears the thump for the second time. She's got to get out of here. 10 minutes later, she smoked four of Rakesh's cigarettes outside the back of the building herself. Health be damned. She knows, deep down, somewhere she can't name, that it's her job, isn't it? To stop the murder, to figure out why it happens and to prevent it. As though the universe agrees with her, it begins to rain as she's finishing her fifth cigarette. Huge, fat drops that turn the air frigid. Jen is slumped, back on the blue kitchen sofa. She left work early. Shouldn't taking the knife have stopped the murder and therefore ended the time loop? Is there an alternative reality where it still happened? Is there another Jen, one who didn't go backwards but who is still moving forwards? Todd is out. With friends, he said, the same as last time. More short texts, more distance between them. Jen is Googling Andy Vertese. He is indeed a professor in the Department of Physics at Liverpool John Moores University. He is easy to find. On LinkedIn, on the university's own page, and he runs a Twitter account called @AndysWorld, his email address in his bio. She could write to him. She sits up as she hears the front door. Can't stop, Todd barks, bursting into the kitchen in a blur of cold air and teenage movement, disturbing Jen's hesitation over a message box. Okay, she says. It isn't what she said last time. Last time she asked if there was a reason why he never wanted to be at home. She's surprised to see the softer approach works. Been to Connor's, now off to Cleo's, Todd explains, meeting her eyes. He bounces from foot to foot as he fiddles with a portable phone charger, full of verb, full of the optimism of somebody for whom life truly is only just beginning. Not the behaviour of a killer, Jen finds herself thinking. Connor, Pauline's eldest. There is something about him that Jen isn't quite sure of, some edge to him. He smokes and he swears, both things Jen does from time to time, but nevertheless both offensive when seen through the ruthless lens of motherhood. She props herself up on her elbow, looking at Todd. She missed him coming home the last time. She'd been at work. A case had taken over for the last few weeks, meaning Jen had missed more of her home life than usual. She is often this way when a big ancillary relief case is heading to trial. The neediness and heartbreak of her clients invades Jen's already poor boundaries, leading her to take constant calls and practically sleep at the office. Gina Davis was the client who had kept Jen busy during October, but not for the usual reasons. She had walked into Jen's office for the first time in the summer with a divorce petition from her husband, who'd left her the week before. "I want to stop him ever seeing the kids again," Gina said. She had curled her blonde hair carefully, worn an immaculate skirt suit. "Why?" Jen had said. "Is there some concern?" "No, he's a great father." Okay. To punish him. She was 37, heartbroken and angry. Jen felt an immediate kinship with her, the kind of woman who doesn't hide her emotions, the kind of woman who speaks the taboo. "I just want to hurt him," she said to Jen. I can't charge you for this, Jen had said. It wasn't the right thing to do, she thought, to profiteer off this. Soon enough, Gina would come to her senses and stop. So do it for free, Gina said, and Jen had. Not because her late father's firm didn't need the money, but because Jen knew, eventually, that Gina would drop it, accept the decree nisi, accept the residency split, and move on. But it hadn't happened yet. Not after Jen told Gina to go away and think about it over the summer and advised against it in the many meetings during the autumn. They'd chatted, too, about all sorts, their kids, the news, even Love Island. Gross but compelling, Gina had said, while Jen laughed and nodded. Jen looks at Todd now and wonders suddenly if he's in love, like Gina is. Wonders who this Cleo really is to him, what she means. The madness of first love cannot be overlooked, surely, given what he does in 2 days' time. Jen has not met Cleo. After Gemma dumped him over the summer, Todd became automatically secretive about his love life, embarrassed, Jen thinks, that it didn't last. Embarrassed about that evening when he'd showed her all those unanswered texts. Just as he's getting ready to go out again, he glances just once at the front door. It isn't a quick, curious glance. It's something else. Some wariness, like he's expecting somebody to be there. Like he's nervous. Jen never would have noticed it had she not been scrutinising him. It's so quick, his expression, clearing almost immediately. What's that? Todd says, looking back at her and gesturing to her screen. Oh, I was just reading this interesting thing about time loops, you know? Love that, Todd says. He's gelled his hair upwards in a kind of quiff, has on a retro-looking snooker shirt. He's recently into it, says he likes the maths of potting the balls. Jen looks at him, her damningly handsome son. What would you do if you were caught in one? She asks him. Oh, it's almost always about some tiny detail, Todd says casually. What do you mean? You know, the butterfly effect. One tiny thing to change the future. Todd reaches down to stroke the cat, and just for a second, looks like a child again. Her boy, who believes unquestioningly in time loops. Perhaps she will tell him, see what he says. But for now she can't. If this is really, truly happening, it is Jen's job to stop the murder, to figure out the events leading up to it and to intervene. And then, one day, when she manages that, she will wake up and it won't be yesterday. And so that is why she doesn't tell Todd. He leaves. And Jen checks that nobody is waiting for him or following him. And then Jen follows him herself. Day minus two, 1900. Jen is two cars behind Todd and is paradoxically relieved to find that he is an incompetent driver. Not once, so far as she can tell, has he checked his rearview mirror and spotted her. He slows down on a road called Ishi Road North. It would be described by an estate agent as leafy, as though plants don't grow on housing estates. There are pumpkins on some of the steps to the houses, carved early, lit up, grotesque reminders of everything that's to come. Todd parks his car carefully. Jen drives to a side street, a few houses down, unlit, so she is hopefully unseen, and gets out, drawing her trench coat around her. The night air has that early autumn spooky feel to it. Damp spiderwebs, the feeling of something coming to an end before you're truly ready to leave it. Todd walks purposefully down the road, white trainers kicking up the leaves. It is so strange for Jen to witness this, the things that happened while she was lawyering, while she was busy caring too much about work and, clearly, not enough about home. She stands at the junction of the side street and Ishi Road North until Todd disappears abruptly inside a house. It is large, set back from the road with a kind of porch and a loft conversion. These kinds of places still intimidate Jen, who grew up in a two-bedroom terrace that had windows so rickety the breeze wafted her hair around in the evenings. Her father, widowed, didn't notice the draft, and anyway took on too much legal aid work and not enough private to fix it, even if he did. She rounds her shoulders against the cold, a woman in a too thin coat on a rainy street, looking at the trees covered in their burnt orange jackets, just thinking. About Todd, and about her father, and about today, tomorrow, and yesterday. She paces down the street. Todd's inside number 32. She Googles the address while she waits, her fingers so cold she can't type easily. It's listed as the registered office of Cutting and Sewing Limited, which is owned by Ezra Michaels and Joseph Jones. It was set up recently and has never submitted any accounts. As Todd is swallowed up into the house, someone else leaves. She's right in the way. The figure comes through the garden gate just as she passes, and suddenly she is face to face with a dead man. No, that's not right. A man who dies in 2 days' time. The victim. Day minus 2, 1920. Jen would recognize him anywhere, even though he, currently, has light in his eyes, colour in his cheeks. This very much alive man with mere days to live looks like somebody who was perhaps once attractive. He is mid-40s, maybe older. He has a full dark beard and elfin ears that point out at their tips. "Hi there," Jen says spontaneously to him. "All right," he says warily. His body goes completely still except his black eyes, which run over her face. She tries to think. She needs as much information as possible. Isn't honesty by far the best policy? With clients, with opponents at work, and with your son's enemies too. "Todd is my son," she says simply. "I'm Jen." "Oh, you're Jen. Jen Brotherhood," he replies. He seems to know her. "I'm Joseph." His voice is gravelly, but he talks in an authoritative kind of way, like a politician. Joseph Jones, it must be the man whose company is registered here. "Nice kid, Todd. Dating Ezra's niece, isn't he?" "Ezra is my friend and business partner." Jen swallows, trying to digest this information. "Look, I just wondered, I'm a bit worried about him, Todd. Sorry to just drop by," she says lamely. "You're worried?" he cocks his head. "Yeah, you know, worried he's got in with a bad..." "Todd's in safe hands. All right now," he says, an instant dismissal by a pro. He motions to her, a kind of "which way are you going" gesture. No mistake about it, it means choose, because you are going whether you like it or not. She does nothing, so he brushes past, leaving her there, alone in the mist, wondering what's happening. Whether the future has continued on without her, if there's another Jen somewhere, asleep or too shocked to function, in the world where Todd is probably currently remanded, arrested, charged, convicted, alone. She decides to ring the doorbell. The depressing lack of tomorrow has made her fatalistic, and thinking of Todd in police custody has made her desperate. "I just wanted to know that he's okay," Jen says to the stranger at the door. He must be Ezra, slightly younger than Joseph, a thick-set man with a bent nose. "Mom?" Todd says from somewhere deep in the house. He emerges into the gloom of the hallway. He looks pale and harassed. Jen thinks the house was once nice but is now the shabby side of shabby chic, worn Victorian quarry tiles, a few offcuts of carpet overlap in the hall like old papers. "What?" Todd says to her, making his way past all this. He communicates his bewilderment to her with a tense smile. A beautiful young woman emerges out of the living room at the end of the hallway, opening the door with her hip. It must be Cleo. Jen can tell by the way she moves towards Todd that they are a couple. She has a Roman nose, a very short, cool fringe, faded jeans, rips across the knees, tanned skin, no socks, a pink t-shirt with cutouts. Even her shoulders are attractive, two peaches. She's tall, almost Todd's height. Jen feels a 100-year-old fool. "What's wrong?" Todd says. "What's happened?" His voice is so assertive, so irritated. He talks down to her. How had she not noticed? "Nothing," she says lamely. "I had a text from you. You sent your location," she lies. She looks beyond him again to the rest of the house. Cleo and Todd's tanned skin and white smiles look out of place against the walls, bare plaster, and the living room door, grubby with a loose handle. Jen frowns. Todd gets his phone out of his pocket. Nope. Oh, sorry, I assumed you wanted me to come. Todd squints at her, waving his phone. I didn't send anything. Why didn't you call? As he moves his arm in that way, she is reminded of the precise stabbing motion he made. Forceful, clean, intentional. She shudders. You're Jen, Ezra says. Jen blinks, recognition the same way Joseph said her name. Todd must talk about her. That's right, she tells him. Sorry, I won't make a habit of dropping by. Jen is trying to gather as much information as possible before she is imminently expelled by Todd. She casts her gaze about, looking for evidence. She doesn't know what she's looking for. She won't know until she finds it, she guesses. Ezra is standing with his back against a cupboard. Mom, Todd says. He's smiling, but his eyes communicate an urgent dismissal. The house doesn't smell like a home. That's what it is. No cooking smells, no laundry, nothing. Sorry, before I go, would you mind if I just use your toilet, Jen says. She just wants to get in, to have a look round, to see what secrets the house might hide. Oh, God, Mom, Todd says, his whole body a teenage eye roll. Jen holds her hands up. I know, I'm sorry, I'll be just a second. She gives Ezra a wide smile. Where is it? You're 5 minutes from home. This is middle age, Todd. Todd dies on the spot, but Ezra indicates the living room door wordlessly. Yes, she's in. Jen squeezes past Todd and Cleo and emerges into a room at the very back of the house, a combined kitchen lounge. It's square, with another door off to the right. There are no photographs on the walls, more bare plaster. A large printed piece of material hangs over the far wall with the sun and moon stitched onto it. She peers behind it, looking for, what, a secret cupboard? But of course she doesn't find one. Jen opens the door to the downstairs toilet and runs the tap, then walks a slow circle around the kitchen. It's mostly bare. Worn tiles underfoot, crumbs along the kitchen counters, that musty smell, the smell of old and empty dwellings. No fruit in the fruit bowl, no reminder letters on the fridge. If Ezra does live here, he doesn't appear to spend much time at home. A large TV is affixed to the left-hand wall. An Xbox sits underneath that. On top of the console rests an iPhone, lit up and blessedly unlocked. Jen picks it up, scrolling straight to the messages. In there she finds Todd's text to, she assumes, Cleo. Todd. I am attracted to you like covalent bonds, you know? Cleo. You make me lol. You are a nerderino. Todd. I am your nerderino, right? Cleo. You are mine, kiss kiss, forever. Jen stares at them. She scrolls further up, feeling guilty as she does so, but not enough to stop. Cleo. This is your morning update. One coffee consumed, two croissants, 1,000 thoughts about you. Todd. Only 1,000. Cleo. Now 1,001. Todd. I've had 1,000 croissants and only a few thoughts. Cleo. Sounds perfect, TBH. Todd. Can I say something serious? Cleo. Wait, you weren't being serious? Have you had 2,000 croissants? Todd. I literally would do anything for you. Kiss. Cleo, same, kiss. Anything. Jen doesn't like that word. Anything implies all sorts. It implies crimes. It implies murder. She wants to read further, but she hears footsteps and stops. She replaces the phone on the console. Cleo really likes him, possibly loves him. She sighs and scans the room, but there's nothing else. She flushes the toilet, turns the tap off, then leaves. Jen pulls up Andy Vertese's details in the car. She needs help. She emails him on a whim, having been sent away by her embarrassed son. Dear Andy, you don't know me, but I'm Rakesh Kapoor's colleague, and I really would like to speak to you about something I'm experiencing, which I believe you have studied. I won't say any more for fear of sounding unhinged, but do email me back, please. Best, Jen. How was work? Kelly says as she walks in through the door. He's sanding down a bench he's restoring for them, the sort of solitary activity Kelly enjoys. Jen knows what the finished product will look like. He sprays it sage green in 2 days' time. Bad, Jen says semi-honestly. She needs to try to tell him again. Kelly wanders over and absent-mindedly takes her coat off, the sort of thing she will never get used to. She loves it so much, the simple care and attention he brings to their marriage. He kisses her. He tastes of mint chewing gum. Their hips touch, their legs interlock. It's seamless. Jen feels her breathing automatically slow. Her husband has always had this effect on her. Your clients are nutcases, he deadpans, his mouth still next to hers. I'm worried about Todd, she says. Kelly steps back. He's not himself. Why? The heating clicks on, the boiler firing up with a soft flare. I'm worried he's in with a bad crowd. Todd? What bad crowd is that? Warhammer lovers? Jen can't help but laugh at this. She wishes Kelly would show the outside world this side of him. Life's too long for this worry, he adds. It's a phrase of theirs spanning back decades. She's sure he started it, and he's sure she did. This Cleo, I'm not sure about her. He's still seeing Cleo. What do you mean? I thought he said he wasn't. Anyway, I have something for you, he says. Don't spend your money on me, she says softly. Kelly has always paid cash in hand and frequently buys her gifts with it. I want to, he says. It's a pumpkin, he adds. This distracts Jen entirely. What? She says. Yeah, you said you wanted one. I was going to buy it tomorrow, she whispers. Okay, look, it's in here. Jen peers around him, looking into the kitchen. Sure enough, there it is. But it isn't the same one. It's huge and grey. The sight of it chills her skin. What if she changes too much? What if she changes things that don't relate to the murder? Isn't that what always happens in the movies? The protagonists change too much. They can't resist. They get greedy, play the lottery, kill Hitler. I'm supposed to buy the pumpkin. Hey? Kelly, yesterday I told you I was living days backward. Surprise breaks across his features like a sunrise. Hey? She explains it the same way she did to Rakesh, the same way she already has to Kelly. The first night, the knife in his bag, everything. Where is this knife now? I don't know, his bag, probably, she says impatiently, wanting to not revisit conversations they have already had. Look, this is fucking ridiculous, he says. She can't say she's surprised by this reaction. Do you think you should, like, see a GP? Maybe, she says in a whisper. I don't know. But it's true. What I'm saying is true. Kelly just stares at her, then at the pumpkin, then back. He goes into the hallway and finds Todd's school bag, empties it theatrically onto the hallway floor. No knife falls out. Jen sighs. Todd probably hasn't bought it yet. Forget it, she says, if you won't believe me. She turns to walk away. It's pointless, even with him. She concedes as she ascends the stairs that she wouldn't believe him either. Who would? I don't, she hears him say at the bottom of the stairs, but then he stops himself. Jen is most disappointed in that half-uttered sentence. Kelly likes an easy life at times, and this is clearly one of them. She showers in a rage. Well then, if sleeping might be what makes her wake up in yesterday, then she simply won't do it. That's her next tactic. Kelly falls asleep immediately, the way he always does, but Jen sits up. She sees the clock turn 11 and 11:30 when Todd comes back. At midnight, she stares and stares at her phone as 0000 becomes 0001. And the date flicks, just like that, from the 27th to the 28th, the way it should. She goes downstairs and watches the rolling BBC news, which segues into the local news about a road traffic accident that happened on the junction of two roads nearby at 11 o'clock last night. A car rolled over and the owner escaped unhurt. She sees the clock strike one, then two, then three. Her eyes become gritty, the adrenaline and the irritation at Kelly wearing off. She does laps of the living room. She makes two coffees, and after the second, she sits on the sofa, just for a second, the news still rolling. The accident, the weather, tomorrow's papers, today. She closes her eyes just for a second, just for 1 second, and... Ryan. Ryan Hiles is 23 years old, and he is going to change the world. It is his first day at work, his first day as a police constable. He has suffered through the application and interview process. He has endured the Police Regional Training Centre, 12 weeks in dreary Manchester. He has queued with the other officers on a herringbone floor, waxed and polished, and been given his uniform in a clear plastic bag, a white shirt, a black vest, his police number, 2648, on his shoulders. And finally, here he is in the foyer, his hair wet from the relentless rain, but otherwise ready. He put the uniform on last night in his bathroom, having waited and waited to do it. He stood on the toilet to see his body in the mirror, and there he was, a policeman. On the toilet, admittedly, but a policeman, nevertheless. More than the uniform, though, Ryan now has what he has always wanted, ability. Specifically, the ability to make a difference. And he is, right now, right this very second, waiting in the station to meet his tutor police officer. "You're assigned to PC Luke Bradford," the inquiry officer on the front desk says to him, her tone bored. She's older, maybe mid-50s, though Ryan has never been very good at guessing ages, hair the colour of a piece of slate. She indicates the row of pale blue bolted-together chairs, and he takes a seat next to a man who he assumes is either a criminal or a witness, a young lad with a ponytail staring at his hands. Outside, rain batters the police station. Ryan can hear it running off the windowsills. It's rained so much it's not been on the news, the wettest October on record, trains not running, parks and gardens a sodden mess of leaves and water. PC Luke Bradford arrives after 20 minutes. Ryan takes three deliberate breaths in and out as he approaches. This is it, the beginning. Bradford crushes Ryan's hand in a shake. He's maybe 5 years older than Ryan. He is still a police constable, so he must be youngish. And yet he has sallow skin, eye bags, smells of coffee. His dark hair is salted at the temples and above his ears. Ryan is athletic, if he does say so himself, and he swallows as he looks at Bradford, takes in the small paunch clearly protruding over his black trousers. "All right, welcome. God, is it still fucking raining?" Bradford glances out at the car park. "First up, parade, then 999 jobs." He turns away from Ryan and leads him into the bowels of the place he will call work. Parade. Bradford uses old-school language, but still his first briefing. Ryan feels a dart of excitement like pins and needles in his stomach. "Kettle on," Bradford says to him. "Oh, sure," Ryan says, hoping to sound willing. "Tea rounds on the newbie," he indicates the briefing room. "Find out what everyone wants." He claps him on the shoulder as he leaves. "Okay, then." It's fine, Ryan tells himself. He can make tea. But tea, it turns out, is complicated. 15 cups, different strengths, different sweetnesses, different fucking milks. Canderel, proper sugar, the works. Ryan's hands are trembling by the time he's ferried the last few mugs out, his knuckles burning. When he reaches the briefing room, just as parade begins, he realises he hasn't made one for himself. The sergeant, Joanne Zamo, is in her late 40s, has the kind of wide smile that takes over a face. She begins to run through the list of active jobs, none of which Ryan understands. He is the only new PC here. The rest have been dispersed across the north. He gazes around the room, looking at the 15 coppers and their 15 cuppers. He'd hoped to find a mate here, someone his age. Ryan left school at 18, worked office jobs with friends for the last few years. He had a great gig, ordering stationery where nobody actually expected him to do anything productive, but still wanted to pay him. He'd thought it was great, for a while, but it turns out ordering rulers and A4 lined paper is not enough for Ryan. He woke up one morning 6 months ago and thought, is this it? And then he'd applied to join the police. Zamo is giving out the list of call jobs. "Right," she adds. "Okay, who have we got here in new recruits? You." Her brown eyes light on Ryan. "Your tutor is Bradford." That's right, Bradford says before Ryan can. Okay, you're Echo, she looks straight at Ryan, and Mike.
Mike, Ryan says. Sorry, no, I'm Ryan, Ryan Hiles.
A flutter of Bradford's eyelashes, a frisson that Ryan fails to understand. A beat, and then the room erupts. Echo Mike, Bradford says, laughing as though it's a punchline. He has one hand on the doorframe and one hand on his stomach. Did you not learn about the phonetic alphabet at the Manchester Academy, or do they not teach that these days? Oh, yes, yes, Ryan says, his cheeks hot. No, I did. I just, sorry, I thought Mike confused me for just a second there. Right, the sergeant says, clearly unimpressed at the unbridled laughter. Just as it stops, it begins again, a wave coming from where CID are clustered. Great. Echo Mike 245, Bradford says clearly, trying to move on. He moves towards Ryan. I'll do the first response, then let you pick up the second, he adds, hurrying them out of the briefing room. Ryan daren't ask what he means. They walk down a green-carpeted corridor that smells of hoovering. They reach a locker and Bradford hands Ryan a radio. All right, that's yours. Calls come in like this. Echo Mike, your vehicle number. You respond with your collar number. Yours is 2648 from your shoulder, right? Okay, Ryan says. Okay. Every officer spends their first 2 years on 999 calls. Anything could come in. A burglary, a murder. Right, great, Bradford says. Let's go. He makes a gesture which says both, this way, please, and, Christ, I hope you're not a fucking idiot. And Ryan walks back out through the reception and into the rain. This is EM245, all right? Like Zamo said, Bradford says, gesturing to the police car. The stripes, the lights. Ryan can't stop looking at it. Okay, he says, sure. He opens the passenger seat and gets in. It smells of old cigarettes. Echo Mike 245, 245 from Echo, says the radio. Echo from Mike 245, go ahead, Bradford says, tonelessly back. He hasn't turned the engine on yet, is still twanging the gear stick. Next, he checks the lights work, hits a huge button on the dashboard which bathes them in blue. Ryan sits with his legs crossed in the footwell, listening to the radio. Yes, thanks, we've got reports of an elderly male who appears drunk and is being offensive to passers-by. Ryan checks his watch. It's 8:05 in the morning. Echo from Mike 245, that's received, on our way. Bradford finally starts the car's engine and puts it into gear. It'll be old Sandy, he remarks. Ryan, terrified that there is also a letter of the police alphabet hidden in this sentence, says nothing. Homeless guy, nice guy, Bradford says, checking his rearview mirror as he pulls out. We'll just probably give him another warning. Call an ambo if he's in a really bad way. Vodka's his thing. Drinks pints and pints of it. Amazing constitution, really. Ryan watches the traffic as they wait at a set of lights. It is a totally different experience to driving his civilian car. You'd be forgiven for thinking everyone was an exemplary driver. It's like something from The Truman Show. Everyone acting, hands at 10-2, eyes straight ahead. Amazing how well-behaved everyone is, Ryan says, and Bradford says nothing. Ryan keeps thinking about old Sandy and his vodka, and of course about his own brother. What's his history, Ryan says. Old Sandy's. No idea. Wonder if we could ask. Ha! Bradford says, his eyes looking straight ahead. Yeah, if we did that for everyone, we'd be fucking heroes, right? Right, Ryan says softly. The rain has smudged the lines outside to a soft blur, the streets reflecting brake lights and the white skies. First rule of the job, almost all 999 calls are boring or involve idiots. Usually both, Bradford says flatly. You can't save idiots. Okay, great, Ryan says sarcastically. Second rule, the new recruits are always far too soft. They arrive at the beach and Bradford parks neatly in a space. Ryan doesn't dignify his remarks with an answer. Come on in, Mike, Bradford says as he gets out. Ryan blushes again. The nickname will stick. He knows it will. This is how it works. He once attended a stag do where one of the stags was called First Floor Wanker the entire weekend, only because of where his hotel room was compared to theirs. Ryan never even learned his real name.
Old Sandy isn't that old. He has the pink, bruised face of an alcoholic, but a lithe body. He is ranting about God as they approach, the whipped-up ocean, an apocalyptic background, the eeriness of the seafront in off-season. All right, old Sandy, Bradford says. Sandy stops and pulls his coarse hair back from his forehead in recognition. It's you, he says sincerely to Bradford. I hoped it would be you. It turns out later that his name is Daniel, not Sandy. The police call him Sandy because he sleeps at the beach. Ryan looks up at the rain on the way to the next call-out and sighs. 6 incidents later, one domestic violence, the 14th call-out made by the wife who can never bring herself to press charges. That was the most depressing, but also, inappropriately, the most interesting. The rest, well, a man who urinated through the letterbox of a funeral parlour, a fight between 2 dog owners about littering, a cash point that had eaten a £10 note. Seriously, mundane is the right word for it. Ryan arrives back at the police station with Bradford at 6 o'clock, his police uniform soaked through, as exhausted as if he hasn't slept. See you in the morning, Mike, Bradford says, chuckling to himself as they head inside. But Ryan can't clock off. He's got to fill in a training record about each call-out before he can go home. He's actually looking forward to the quiet of a little meeting room, the chance to reflect, to get his thoughts in order, to have a fucking cup of tea at last. His brain feels like a shaken snow globe. He thought it would be different to this. He walks into the foyer, past the inquiry officer, a different one, but with the same bored expression, and through a quiet corridor with a panic strip along the side. He is hoping to catch a glimpse of a suspect being interviewed, or of the cells, of anything, really. Anything except 999 calls, 6 calls a day, 4 days on, 3 off, 48 weeks a year, 2 years. Ryan can't be bothered to work out how many calls that is, but he knows it's a lot. Maybe today was just an anomaly, a bad day. Maybe Bradford is just jaded. Maybe tomorrow will be interesting. Maybe, maybe. He pushes open the door to an empty meeting room. It has 2 doors for soundproofing. He pulls a chair up at a cheap metal table, the kind you'd find in a village hall. He gets a notebook out of his vest pocket and takes a pen from a red plastic pot in the corner of the table and scrawls the date along the top. He was supposed to make these notes at the time, but Bradford told him that was training school bollocks. He begins to write about Sandy, then stops, wanting to think instead, wanting to think about how he can make a difference. Looking back, his brother had started to go wayward, as his mother used to say, when he was in his late teens. It started with nicking cars, which escalated to selling drugs, all the way from puff to gear as fast as 0 to 60. What would Bradford have to say about that? He'd probably have thought his brother was wasting police time too, a predictable set of affairs, no male role model, no prospects. Their mum had tried her best, but she wasn't always there. She had 2 jobs. His brother, in a funny sort of way, wanted to help with the finances. That's all. And he did, for a while. He did bring the money in, though they all wondered where from. Ryan upends the pen against the notebook. Maybe he is making a difference to people like his brother. Old Sandy was pleased to see them, seemed to know Bradford well anyway. Maybe they are helping him, just not in the way Ryan expected. Bugger it, Ryan thinks. He'll do the notebook tomorrow. He's not in the right mood now. He opens the door to the meeting room. A big guy is walking past. He's wearing a suit. CID, maybe. Ryan feels something positive bloom across his chest. Yes, yes, yes. There's still plenty of opportunities here to do interesting things and to make a difference. That's all Ryan wants to do. Isn't that all anyone wants to do? All right, Ryan says to the man. He's tall, well over 6 feet, and thick-set too. Looks kind of like a computer game villain. First day? Ryan nods. Yeah, on response. Fun, 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 the man laughs. He holds a warm hand out. Pete, but everyone calls me Muscles. Nice to meet you, Ryan says. Your CID? For my sins? He leans against the magnolia-painted wall. He takes a stick of gum out and offers one to Ryan, who takes it. Mint explodes in his mouth. Any good jobs for you today? Who's your tutor? Bradford.
Ouch.
Right, Ryan smiles. No good call-outs yet. No, I bet not. So, you're not local, the accent. No, commuting across from Manchester, he says. Yeah? What brought you here, then? The pull of the non-stop fascinating 999 calls? Something like that, Ryan says. And, you know, wanting to make a difference? He uses air quotes.
You'll soon regret that. Muscles pushes himself off the wall, then wanders down the corridor. Ryan follows him out. Just before they come to the door that leads to the inquiry office, Muscles turns back.
You know, it can be a good thing not to know the lingo, he says. You'll find out why.
You heard the mic thing, Ryan says.
Exactly, Muscles says, barely hiding a smile.
Well, yeah, I'm not that up on the lingo, but I'm going to be, he says.
Well, don't get too good, Ryan, Muscles says, enigmatically. He chews the gum for a few more seconds, staring at the door, thinking. Not all good policemen talk like them.